and welcome to this week's Guardian Tech Weekly, the self-styled answer to the winter blues. We're here to redefine the meaning of SAD. It now stands for Seriously Awesome Digest, so take heart. Now, before we go any further, if you're listening to this on an iPod or an iPhone, you can download an enhanced podcast with pictures. So stop the podcast, go over to guardian.co.uk/techweekly, download the new version and start again. But for the rest of us, it's on with the show. Today, we speak to Phil McKinney, Global CTO of Hewlett-Packard, on all things computer-related. And we'll also be putting the mammoth 12-megapixel camera phone through its paces, or rather the Guardian Photodesk will do it for us. So, can Sony Ericsson's Satio live up to their exacting standards? With 12 megapixels, does the Satio have the rest of the specs to make it a must-have phone? I'm Susie Weezer, and I'm in a rather lonely studio alone today. So there's nothing for it but to wrap up warm and head on out as we take steps into the technology wilds. On with the show. According to IDC figures, Hewlett-Packard were last year ranked at number one for notebook and PC sales, as well as laser and inkjet printers. Over the next few years, they're set to invest over $20 billion in R&D, making them a key player in the technology of the future. So far, so massive. And whilst Phil McKinney's day job is global CTO of HP, his alter ego is as the host of the Killer Innovations podcast, where he shares his thoughts on trends, ideas and innovations. So there was lots to talk about when The Guardian's Kevin Anderson caught up with Phil last week.
What's the next big thing? We're just on the edge of 2010. I can see it from here. What's going to be interesting, not just in 2010, but even just a little further out?
One of the things that we think is interesting is some new categories of form factors. But what we've seen over the last year is really this gap that's happened above the smartphones, but below the notebooks. So kind of below 10 inches on the screen size on the notebooks, but above 4 inches on the mobile phones. And the one thing that we think is really going to emerge in that category is a new device we call the slates. So think of the slate really as, you know, ripping the glass off the top of a tablet PC, but having full touch capabilities, but being kind of in that 5 to 8 inch screen size mechanism, and really aimed as a content consumption device.
So this isn't a full computer. It's more of a specialized device.
Well, there's two kinds of category devices. You know, there's a horizontal place and then there's strong specifics. You know, Kindle would be classified as a strong specific. It does only one device. This being a little bit more of a horizontal, allowing you to run a variety of different applications, but think of it as primarily a cloud-based content consumption kind of an experience. I mean, the rumors are out there. You can read all the blog sites. Everybody's been talking about it. But it's a unique segment from the standpoint of nobody quite knows what the right screen size is. Because if you think about it, some people came into the netbook market with 7-inch screens, totally got rejected by the marketplace. So that category is kind of solidified at the 10-inch. Mobile phones, you get above 4.5 inches, everybody rejects them as being no longer pocketable, so there's no longer a phone. What's going to happen in this middle category? There's clearly a space between 4.5 and 10 inches, but what does that device really need to be?
Exactly, and you were saying it's more of a content delivery device. What kind of content are we going to see on this?
Well, think about it with the restrictions that you have today in ebook readers. You know, they're black and white only, very slow refresh, great battery life. But what people are saying is I have more content than just what I normally get from a printed page. There's magazines where color and imagery is important, video is becoming increasingly important, audio is becoming important. I need a device that can support all of the kinds of content that I want to enjoy.
So content companies, what are they going to see with this kind of device? I mean, obviously the content business has been taking a bit of a beating during the recession, and what opportunities do you see for them?
Well, the content guys are all trying to figure out what's the new play. One, I think part of it is the restrictive nature in the content business on ad revenues. Particularly, you look at magazine publishing where it has to be an audited subscriptions and all of those types of things, and they don't recognize digital as being an equivalent to a subscription. So there's a big change going underway in the print publishing industry as far as how do you change your business model. But you've seen it in some cases. If you look at the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, where they've come out with their own Adobe Air Reader device, software that's available for people to be able to read their contents. They're all off trying to figure out what is the magazine of the newspaper of the future. And let's face it, it's no longer just about the printed page that I can put on a piece of paper. It's things like doing these podcasts. It's like publishing videos. It's about other kinds of information that gets blended in together to make that content richer, more real time, more sensitive to the specific interest I can subscribe to if I'm a technologist. So to be quite honest, in the morning I read the tech section online for the Wall Street Journal before I read the business section because that's my background. So how do you allow people to tailor the kind of information they get?
Now, you mentioned the cloud. And obviously, a device like that is going to be pulling your video, pulling your audio off of storage somewhere else. What other opportunities across the range of these devices? And so your smartphones, your slates, as you call them, mm-hmm. and then up to netbooks and then to full featured things.
The challenge today is if you try to go to a full cloud model, the one constraint we have is the network. So if you look at it just in the context of the United States, if you took every bit of data that sits on PCs today in the U.S., and you were just to transmit it across the backbone network in the U.S., just across the country, it would take you 11 months to transmit all that data. So if you had all those users with all that data going back and forth to the cloud, the network would literally roll over and die. So the challenge becomes then is the network is still a constraining resource. So you will still have some form of local storage, local compute. The question is where does that line shift from being 100% cloud to being 100% client? Where does that end up in the middle?
HP just bought a pioneer in networking, 3Com. Mm-hmm. What's 3Com going to bring to HP and more importantly, in my Christmas bag in 2011?
It's brought in as getting combined with our ProCurve division, which has been the HP networking division, and which you find if you looked at the ProCurve product line and the 3Com product line, that there was actually very little overlap, which is what's making this acquisition, very attractive from the standpoint of HP. ProCurve was heavily focused on wireless access points, particularly in small and medium-sized businesses and even in the enterprise. 3Com had very good and core switching, core high-speed network switching application-specific server application switching applications. And so from that standpoint, we saw very little overlap between the ProCurve and 3Com. So when you put the two together, it actually allows us to have really a full suite of offerings for any enterprise, no matter their size, in being able to bring both their switching and their networking needs.
With the iPhone and increasingly other smartphones, people are using data in a way that we just haven't seen before, in some ways, crashing the networks. We've got 4G just on the horizon. You even start to see some certain things, WiMAX with Clearwire mm-hmm. in the U.S. and some other plays. Is that going to come? Are we going to finally start seeing some big 4G rollouts in the next year or 2 years? And if so, what does that bring that we don't have now?
Well, I think you're going to see there's really a horse race now for the 4G networks. You got LTE rolling out, and we got WiMAX. If you'd asked me a couple of years ago who I thought would have won, I would have probably been picking WiMAX. But I think WiMAX has kind of missed a little bit of the window of opportunity. Same time, though, you got LTE, a lot of promise. Early trial networks are up and running. I mean, the ultimate objective is to get into, tens to hundreds of megabits up to gigabit kind of performance on wireless. Now, with that said, wireless will never be able to meet the speed of fiber-wired networks. The cost per bits per hertz is just too high for them to be able to drive to that kind of a performance. But with that said, 3G, 4G, when you start thinking about 100 megabits to a device or a gigabit, and we predict kind of in the 2018 to 2020 range, you're talking about gigabit range to mobile devices. And you start thinking about what can you do with a gigabit to a mobile device, opens up a huge amount of possibilities. And it starts to break down that bottleneck of the network on what you can do cloud versus local client. So it opens up a huge amount of opportunities, collaboration, video streaming, all kinds of new applications we can't even think of today.
So we're coming to the end of a decade. What do you think was the most disruptive, interesting technology in the last 10 years, and what do you think that will be the most interesting disruptive technology in the next 10?
Well, I think probably the most disruptive technology over the last 10 years, you'd have to say, is going to be the mobility of data. The fact that we've got now such a footprint and availability of mobile data and what that allows you to do and what that allows you to reach and things that we'd never thought of was going to be available from that standpoint, whether it be providing data services to remote villages in Africa, which I've seen happen and have an impact on the total economics of a village, to just, the fact that today we just kind of ignore it and we just think of it as just being, we get upset when it's not available, let's put it that way. I think for the next 10 years, some interesting technologies that we see coming is, I think, the proliferation of 3D is kind of becoming the new norm of high definition. When you think about 3D, we think about it from the standpoint of a human, what we call human scale. Your audio nerve operates at about a T1. Your optic nerve operates at a gigabit. You have two of them. You see in 3D. And when you take a 3D image and you flatten it to 2D, you're throwing information away. We've proven that by 3D information, doctors and surgeries, business people make looking at data in 3D make better decisions. And therefore, it can drive a huge amount of productivity. Huge technology challenges to deliver 3D and 3D without the funky glasses and all those kinds of things. But, you know, I'm a firm believer that 3D is going to fundamentally change how we see, view, and experience content.
Phil McKinney there, Global CTO of Hewlett-Packard. And now it's time to find out what's been going on in the rest of the world with the latest tech headlines.
Rupert Murdoch is considering a tie-up with Microsoft, which would see the technology group pay for exclusive rights to content from his newspapers. Access to material from The Times and The Sun would be used to attract visitors to Microsoft's Bing search engine. As part of the deal, Murdoch would prevent stories from News Corporation outlets appearing on the rival Google News, despite the bulk of web traffic for sites like Times Online coming from Google. The talks are part of Murdoch's drive to create new online revenue streams and bring to an end what he sees as the theft of his content by large web companies such as search engines and the BBC. Lord Mandelson is seeking to amend the laws on copyright to give the government sweeping new powers against people accused of illegal downloading. Internet service providers, meanwhile, have warned that the scheme is unworkable and unlawful. The proposed alteration to the 1988 Copyright Designs and Patents Act would create a new offence of downloading material that infringes copyright laws, as well as giving new powers to protect rights holders, such as record companies and movie studios. Controversially, these powers could be granted to any person as may be specified to help cut down online infringement of copyright. Google has announced Chrome OS, a stripped-down operating system designed to do everything inside its own Chrome web browser. It's set to target the fast-growing netbook market with the operating system, which will make the computer work like a TV set, being on the web within seconds of turning the machine on. The computer's applications and data will all be on the web, and users will not be able to install programs themselves. Chrome OS won't be on sale on hardware for a year, but Google said it was talking to leading manufacturers and hoped to have systems on the market for next Christmas, and it released an early version of the code to the open source development community. And a second iPhone worm has been discovered, which has been targeting website users of the Dutch bank ING by redirecting them to a similar looking site with a login screen. The worm only affects jailbroken iPhones which have not changed their default SSH password. The new worm is more dangerous than the previous discovery, as it can enable the phone to be used in a botnet. Now, Charles has some details of success for the Free Our Data campaign.
Just as last week's episode of Tech Weekly was being put onto the web, I was at number 10 Downing Street, where Gordon Brown and Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the World Wide Web, who was hired by the Prime Minister in June to free up more government data, announced a radical new step. From April next year, Ordnance Survey mid-range mapping data will be free for commercial and non-commercial use online. It's a big win for the Free Our Data campaign, which has been seeking exactly this sort of freedom for the past 3 years. So I caught up afterwards with Tim Berners-Lee and asked him exactly what data is going to be released.
The Ordnance Survey data that's been announced includes the administrative data, which is sort of the administrative boundaries and the sort of statutory things, all those things which basically which you're bound to by being a Brit, things like where the boundaries of voting precincts, paths you're allowed to that you're permitted to go down. That's why one part of it. Where in fact, because it's something which the government is in a way forcing upon you as being a citizen, it's ridiculous that that data should not be in a way for free. It's got general mapping data, sort of street map data, which mid-scale.
That's better than the Land Ranger map, isn't it? That's very detailed at 1 in 10,000.
It's very good for a road map and for a path map. It's it's what you need as a road map in a city, actually.
You went around to lots of government departments, and the message that you got from them was that they really needed this to be free so that they could free up other data sets?
Well, it turns out that it's a key thing. It turns out that lots of data, in fact, is geographically referenced. And if in this country you have data, then typically you tie it to the grid reference, and then you use that grid reference to compare it with other things. But the grid reference itself was part of the Ordnance Survey mapping system. So the moment you've done that, or another example that came up on the web recently, somebody was complaining that they'd taken, people take old maps, they just sort of take a scan of an old map, and then they stretch it using morphing software so that it fits over the grid. So then you can use, so that you can look at that map to see how things used to be, but overlaid onto an existing map. So that when you, so when you've done that stretching, if you stretch it onto another survey map, suddenly that old map, even though it's way out of copyright, becomes, quote, sort of old, copyright Ordnance Survey, unquote, because you've used some of their data to actually peg it out on the right, to stretch it.
This is the derived data problem.
So explicitly getting rid of that derived data problem so that you can, so that suddenly you'll be able to use all these old maps, even if they've been pinned onto the Ordnance Survey grid. So the derived data suddenly becomes available, and that opens up a lot of things which really should have been available before.
And you've got a lot of data sets coming up which are going to be made available through data.gov.uk.
The rule of thumb, if you're in government, pretty much in any country, but if you've got a freedom of information law, if you're looking at a piece of data, which if somebody asked for it under the freedom of information, you would give it to them, then you put it on the web. And we don't even know how many data sets there are out there. I think, though, but so, you know, if you're in government and you're listening to this, then think about what you've got. Okay, and talk to somebody about how to get it onto the web. You know, we're getting more and more little teams who are teaching each other about how to do this. But the first thing to do is just put the data up as it is and let other people give you feedback about whether they like it in a different format or something, but just put it out there. Because you never know how data is going to get used. You never know how somebody will have a question to ask, which involves access to your data to be able to answer it, and it may involve them sort of figuring out how a virus is spreading. It may involve them, you know, tracking down a crime. It may involve them realizing how public services could be improved. There are all kinds of things. Data gets reused in serendipitous ways, and that's the strength of it. That's the power of it. And that's the power which has been locked up until now.
Sony Ericsson's Satio phone is part of the latest wave of megapixel-heavy mobile phones. It boasts 12.1 of those pesky megapixels, a touchscreen focus method, and a xenon flash. But whilst originally camera phones were threatening to kill off the compact camera, there's yet to be one that offers the same kind of functionality and low-light shooting quality that people have come to expect from their camera. We gave the Satio to the Guardian's picture desk to put it through its paces, but would it impress these hard-to-impress snappers? Keep an eye on your iPod or iPhone, if you're listening on one, as they've got photographic results that will be right there in front of your eyes for this next item.
Hello, my name is Ranjit Daliwal. I work on the Guardian newspaper. I'm a picture editor. I work on guardian.co.uk, the Guardian's website. I've been working here for almost 10 years now. My job mainly involves looking at between 4,000 and 5,000 photos a day, selecting them for the website. I've been using digital cameras now since pretty much when they first came out, and have got my hands on this Sony Ericsson Satio. Be interesting to see what this camera with its fantastic 12 megapixel offering can do. Thought it'd be quite interesting to look at how it compares to a normal compact digital camera which is on the market. It has a very high resolution, almost ridiculously too high for a telephone. I'll be interested to see the colour representation, how accurate that is, you know, the quality of the lens, the speed of the camera. Interested to see how it takes a picture in available light and dark conditions, and also using its flash. So we'll take it outside and put it through its paces. It's quite dark and gloomy out here. It's very rough weather, and just come outside to take a portrait or two, just to see firstly how the camera represents kind of flesh tones. Hopefully get a bit of sharpness in the eyes, you never know. But as it's a really windy day and the camera's shaking around quite a lot, I don't really expect great things from this, especially with the lens that it's got. I'm going to take some pictures of these nice colourful canal boats. It's a very windy day, so the wind's moving the water quite quickly. If the shutter is quick enough, then you'll get a nice, crisp and clear image. So I'll give it a go, see how it works. I'll take a picture of this, which I think is a coot, just to demonstrate the speed of the processor and the camera. I suspect that the speed of this processor is actually quite slow, so I'm not too sure about the sharpness of the moving coot. We'll have to wait and see. We've come to the Pangolin Gallery, which is on the ground floor of the building that they share with The Guardian, and they've got an exhibition by John Buck. I've come down here just to judge the colour representation on this camera, see if it's accurate, as it's a common fault with a lot of digital cameras that they don't represent colour very well. So we're just going to photograph this nice blue double-headed sculpture and get someone in front of it just to give the frame a little bit more depth and see how the colour comes out. What I'm going to do here is use its best pick feature, which is the alternative of using a motor drive. In order to capture a moving image well, it takes five or six frames and it selects for you the best and sharpest one. What I'm trying to do here is use a bit of movement and photograph people travelling up and down an escalator. So, and then unfortunately, just as the subject was approaching the camera, because of the slowness of the processor, she'd actually moved in front of me and gone out of the frame before the camera had actually captured an image. The process is very much of the same kind of speed as a digital camera maybe 3 or 4 years ago, where you'd have to focus in front of the subject in order to predict where they're actually going to be in a second or two's time when they're actually going to appear in focus in your frame. This picture of canal boats here is not the best picture in the world, and it hasn't turned out very well at all. Firstly, the colours are quite dull and flat, but it was very challenging photographic conditions, very flat light. They were quite a long way away, so I used the zoom on this camera to try and get close to the subject and fill the frame up. It has a digital zoom. The picture quality has deteriorated somewhat. It's very grainy, slightly soft, and there's no real point of focus, so it's ended up being a very disappointing picture. The next picture is this picture of a coot. There's quite a lot of texture in this picture with the rippling of the water, and I was trying to see what kind of depth of field you get with it. Use a little bit of zoom on it. It's not very sharp. It hasn't dealt very well with the moving either of the water or the subject. With this peak, we were in the gallery at King's Place. Quite difficult artificial light, which is a good test for a digital camera to see exactly how it deals with the white balance of various light sources. There is available light coming through the top left hand corner, and then there's a lot of spotlighting around. It hasn't dealt very well with that. It's turned up quite pink. We were trying to capture a few moving images here. Didn't really do that very well. Pictures aren't sharp. However, it does convey a little bit of movement there, but it's not really what I was after. I was after trying to get the foreground figures in focus, and the camera actually hasn't been able to cope with that at all. This is the shot in the Pangolin Gallery. It's turned out quite well. The oranges and the blues have come out quite naturally. The colours of the coat are quite true to life, and with the available light coming through the window, the whites and the shades in the background give it some quite good depth, so it's not too bad. It's turned out okay, fair to middling. At least it's sharp. Here's a portrait of a handsome young man taken with available light. He's dealt with the flesh tones actually quite well. However, it being very, very windy, the camera was shaking around quite a lot and had quite a difficulty getting a sharp image. Instead of actually focusing on the eyes and the eyes being sharp, it's actually made the beard and mouth in focus and the nose in focus instead. If I was using a digital SLR or a digital compact camera, I would hope that we wouldn't have the same effect. All in all, it's not too bad, but it could be a lot better in terms of sharpness. On the plus side, I think compared to other digital camera phones, it has quite a lot of good features. White balance, it's actually got an exposure feature which you can underexpose or overexpose a frame. It's got an image stabiliser, which is a really good feature. Unfortunately, I couldn't get it to work. Tends to go to sleep quite quickly, which I can understand. It's got a touch screen, so you don't want it to be doing the wrong things while it's in your pocket. However, the touch screen makes the camera so unpredictable that you can either lose your pictures, as I did. It's quite difficult to send texts, quite difficult to operate the keyboard if you're not used to using a touch screen. So unfortunately, it's not very easy to use. It goes to sleep so quickly, it makes it incredibly difficult to navigate in between different applications and things like that. So you have to go through the palaver of opening the lens every single time to get the camera to work. With that, every time you open it up, you smudge your fingers across the lens. As far as a camera phone goes, it's quite good. I mean, if you don't take photography too seriously, it's perfectly adequate. In comparison to even the cheapest of mass market compact cameras, I think it performs quite poorly. However, if you were a citizen journalist and you wanted, if you were on the spot somewhere at a major news event and you took a picture with it, and if you chose to send it into a, you know, newspaper or a magazine, they could actually publish it. And that's the plus side of it, is that the resolution is high enough that they could publish it probably up to a double page. But for most professionals, I think pretty much everyone would say, give me a proper real camera any day.
That was The Guardian's photo expert there on the Sony Ericsson 12 megapixel Satio phone. You can find out more about the handset at sonyericsson.com/Satio.
In this Thursday's tech section with The Guardian, Jack looks at Google's Chrome OS. It's the new big chance, and Google's demonstration of its new operating system for netbooks shows that it could take a significant proportion of the computer market. ISPs explain why they really don't like the proposals in the digital economy bill. And we look at osmotic power. Is it feasible to generate energy from the meeting of sea and fresh water? A demonstration plant in Norway shows how it can be done. All this and more in Thursday's tech section with The Guardian.
That's it for this week, but just before we go, we've got to go over to Flickr. We've got to give props to Dave61, who not only provided us with numerous photos of his office, complete with two separate rat's nests of wires, he also annotated his photos for easy reference. Now, my favourite bit of his photos is his landing zone, where he dumps his numerous gadgets, ready for the next time he leaves the house. Techie and organised. If you've got something you'd like to share with us, be it via Twitter, Facebook, or even some old school email action, you can find links for all of it on guardian.co.uk/techweekly. And don't forget, we're looking for nominations for Jack's Hall of Fame, where we induct the great and the good of the technology world for their services to us, their geeky audience. So nominate away. And with that comes the end of the show. Next week, there'll be more technology news and views, and maybe even some people to join me in the studio. Who knows? But until next Tuesday, I'm Susie Weezer.